to you as well. On my far right, Justice Michael Gableman. Next to him, Justice David Prosser. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left, Justice Rebecca Bradley. So, with those introductions made, let me call the second case for the day, 14 AP 157, Dufour versus Progressive Classic Insurance Company. Are you ready to begin?
Please. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Doug Raines. I represent Dairyland Insurance Company. There's two issues in this case. The first issue is whether Dairyland may retain the subrogated property damage funds received from American Standard. The answer is yes. Dufour should not be paid twice for his property loss because the made-whole doctrine doesn't apply in these circumstances. The court should not rewrite his policy to provide for a combined single limit. The second issue is whether Dairyland committed bad faith when it declined to turn over the subrogated funds to Dufour. The answer is no. Dairyland did not commit bad faith because the defenses it raises here shows that the issue is fairly debatable. Accordingly, the court should reverse the Court of Appeals decision. With respect to the first issue, there are five reasons why Dairyland may retain the subrogated funds. Number one, the made-whole doctrine doesn't apply because there's no competition.
Counsel, would you make sure that you speak up or stay in front of them?
I beg your pardon.
We have such difficulties with the acoustics.
I beg your pardon. I'll repeat what I said.
Five reasons.
The first reason is that there's no competition for a limited pool of funds, so the made-whole doctrine doesn't apply. The second reason is that Dufour's policy provides separate coverages for bodily injury and for property damage, and the court should not...
What about your opposing counsel's argument in the brief that says it's all one indivisible claim, taking language out of one of our cases, saying that that property and personal injury, all part of one indivisible claim. I'd like you to take a minute or two to discuss that.
The case law does indicate that the claim is indivisible. The claim is against the tortfeasor, and it is indivisible in the sense that the insured can pursue a damages claim against the tortfeasor. But when the insurance company pays subrogated funds to the insurance company is assigned a portion of that claim, and that portion of the claim is the subrogation claim that only the insurance company possesses. And the insurance company then is able to subrogate against the tortfeasor's insurance company. The insured doesn't possess that cause of action. So even though the claim is indivisible, the insurance company is assigned a portion of the claim. This
You're
is
saying
discussed.
Because Darylin paid the $15,000 to its insured, and then through its subrogation rights, went back to the tortfeasor's insurance company and said, we paid out the $15,009.
Right.
We want it back.
Right.
Give it to us. That is a claim that only Dairyland can pursue, so therefore it's taken out of the mix in regard to what would otherwise, according to our case law, be an indivisible claim for both property and personal injury.
That is exactly right, and that is borne out in multiple cases from this court. It's borne out in the Mueller case. If you look at paragraphs 53 and 86 in footnote 9 of that case, it discusses how the claim separates between the insured and the insurance company once subrogation is paid. Also, the Blue Cross case and the Mutual Services case show the force of that claim that only the insurance company owes. Because in those cases, the insurance company was permitted to sue the tortfeasor to recover subrogation funds that it had paid to insured, separate and apart from its insured participating in those actions. So, yes, the claim is indivisible, but once subrogation occurs, only the insurance company owns it.
And therefore is, by definition, divisible.
Correct.
I know Justice Bradley has a question, but we've been sort of talking amongst ourselves, and she agreed to let me go first, so thank you for that. But I have kind of a practical question.
Sure.
And it is similar to that which Justice Gableman just asked you, so I just want to ask you this now before you go into the other reasons. If this case were tried to a jury instead of a summary judgment or settled or whatever else,
right.
What would the verdict form look like? I don't think you tell me what the verdict form look like and how the jury would be instructed, because this is usually the award goes and the person gets their award, and then subrogation is dealt with separately. The jury doesn't decide that. So talk to me about that in terms of property damage.
Sure. Sorry for interrupting. I beg your pardon. It is not entirely clear to me what the jury form or what the verdict form would look like. The first issue is really a breach of contract issue. So the jury presumably would be instructed on breach of contract. But I guess the complicating factor here is that the made-whole doctrine is layered on top of the breach of contract issue. And the made-whole doctrine, whether that applies, is strictly an issue of law.
If this were the underlying claim, though, that's what I'm talking about. When the case is first tried based upon the underlying facts, the underlying claim, how does that verdict look? Do you get an award for the motorcycle twice or for the piece of property twice, or how does that work for a jury?
I haven't seen such a verdict form, but I would think, given that the claim becomes divisible once the subrogation is paid, that there's a space for the jury to award subrogation back to the insurance company, and then to award damages then that the insured has inflicted. He would recover then for his property damage, and he would recover presumably for his bodily injury as well.
Okay.
But he wouldn't be able to recover the subrogation funds that his own insurance company paid, because the insurance company is the one that has the cause of action for those funds.
Well, damages are awarded once.
Correct.
Right? And then how the insurance companies work out dividing those damages up is determined later, right?
Probably, although the way I hear your question was that would be involved in the same trial. Maybe I misunderstood.
Basically, it wouldn't. So I was trying to give you an underhand pitch there, I think. But it didn't work.
Nothing worse than not recognizing a friendly question.
So that's how it usually works here when anyone's doing that. I was just trying to figure it out, though, because I really haven't seen it where. But you do deserve damages for each item of loss. So I'm trying to figure out how the made whole doctrine fits on top of this, because it's a little different. So I need counsel to help me with that.
Sure. Well, again, whether the made whole doctrine applies is purely an issue of law. And so the parties here filed cross motions for summary judgment, indicating that there's no dispute of fact here. And the court rendered judgment as a matter of law as to the breach of contract issue.
Understood.
And to the bad faith issue.
Okay. We're just missing each other a little bit. I'm going to go get my jury instructions and take a look for myself.
In this particular case, once the plaintiff was paid, the plaintiff could not get the $15,000 plus from American Standard, right?
Correct.
So if Dairyland didn't seek it, the only thing that happens is that the tortfeasor's insurance company pays less.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's one of the disincentives, I think, of the Court of Appeals decision, why it's erroneous.
Right, so because if you're going to turn it over, why go through all the effort?
Absolutely. The Court of Appeals decision undermines one of the stated policies in this state, and that is to hold tortfeasors accountable. And if insureds in Dufour's position are permitted to retain the subrogated funds that Dairyland retain, then as Your Honor said, Dairyland doesn't have any incentive to subrogate. I think I left off at the fourth reason why Dairyland may retain the
funds. I don't think so. I think you're still at number one.
Oh, I'm still at number one. Okay, let me back up.
I did have a question before you get to number two, unless you handled it in your response without telling us what number two is. I want to look at the Rhymes case. I need some help conceptually. Rhymes extended Garrity to MedPay.
Correct.
Help me if I'm wrong on any of this.
No, that's right.
You know, and I look at MedPay as a distinct form of subrogation possibilities. That is,
It's part of being indemnified from MedPay, much like property damage is a distinct form of indemnification. Now, you are willing to point out the concerns you have in Valley Forge insurance case. But why aren't you attacking Rhymes in the same way?
Sure.
Because it too, although the facts may have played out differently, conceptually you're saying the same thing. It seems to me. Tell me why you're not.
Not quite, Your Honor. Okay. I understand what you're saying about MedPay, but that flows from bodily injury. Rhymes was a case that involved bodily injury only.
That's right.
And in that case, the MedPay funds were paid into escrow. And the insurance company and the insured then fought over who got them.
Yes.
So there was a direct competition for those limited pool of funds. There's multiple distinctions between Rhymes and this case. Again, Rhymes involved bodily injury only. This case involves bodily injury and property damage. And there's no competition for a limited pool of funds because the insurance company is not suing its own insured in subrogation. That was the compelling equitable factor that Mueller noted. It was absent in Mueller, and it's absent here. So there's no competition for a limited pool of funds in this sense, and because of that, the made-whole doctrine doesn't apply in this case.
Well, I understand your distinction with the facts of Rhymes, but I'm taking it beyond the facts. I'm saying your argument impinges on parts of Rhyme. Rhyme said, not merely those damages for which the insurer has indemnified the insured, including those for which he has already been indemnified by an insurer. What I mean by that is the facts in Rhymes are set forth as you indicate. But more broadly speaking, it seems that your argument, which is made because of property damage, having rights of subrogation under the contract, that the made whole doesn't apply. Why doesn't that, in the same sense, apply to MedPay, which has subrogation rights under the contract, if it pays out for MedPay?
I think it could, but in Rhymes, the insurance company, for whatever reason, elected to have its insured have access to those funds.
Yes, it put it into the clerk's
office. Yes, they put it into the kitty for them to fight over it, and they both agreed to do that. We're taking a contrary position from State Farm and Rhymes. We're saying that the insured doesn't have access to those funds to begin with because the insured doesn't possess the cause of action for those funds. So in that way, we are attacking Rhymes, not only conceptually in the way that Your Honor describes it, but also on the facts as well. There's only two cases, as I know, that involve both bodily injury and property damage, which is the scenario here. And that is the Valley Forge case that Dufour relies on. And the second case is a 2014 case from the Montana Supreme Court called Van Orden. And those cases are very different in the sense that in Valley Forge, the tortfeasor's insurance company paid the double property damage funds directly to the insured. And that was fortuitous for him because, again, that was the only way he could access those funds because he didn't have the cause of action for them. And also in Valley Forge, the subrogee insurance company sued its own insured for subrogation in a circumstance where its own insured provided an indemnity agreement to the tortfeasor. So there were two forms of competition for those funds in Valley Forge. Van Orden is on all fours with this case. Van Orden, again, property damage and bodily injury. And the Montana Supreme Court said that the insurance company in that case could retain the subrogated funds for the exact reasons that we're relying on here. One, that the made-whole doctrine didn't apply because there was no competition. Two, the court said we're not going to rewrite the insured's contract from one that provides separate limits for bodily injury and property damage into one that provides for a combined single limit.
Is this your number two?
That's my number two.
Okay, I want to.
Yes.
Okay.
The Valley Forge, my recollection is there was a payment of $6,000 that was due in owing, and the insured got a check for $12,000 because his lawyer thought that's how it had to be done. But doesn't that feed into the second Miller factor, whether the insurer is seeking subrogation from its insured or from the tortfeasor?
I beg your pardon. I missed what you said. The second factor.
It seems to me in Valley Forge, obviously in Valley Forge, the injured's insured was trying to recover $6,000 from its own insured. Here, I think you're ready to go on to factor number two, unless I'm mistaken. Number two, I want to know if that isn't a direct outgrowth or very similarly based on the concept expressed in Valley Forge, as where an insurance company is going after its own insured.
Correct.
For subrogation.
Yes, and Mueller talked about that. That is direct competition between the insured and the insurance company. Because the insured in Valley Forge provided an indemnity agreement, that meant that one way or the other, if his insurance company was going to subrogate, the money had to come out of its own insured's pocket. We're not doing that. We let Dufour collect all the proceeds that he was entitled to. He collected the full value of his property damage, which was over $15,000. Then he collected the $100,000 limits from American Standard. Then he collected the $100,000 UIM limits from Dairyland, and then gave the tortfeasor a release. So he had collected over $215,000 before we subrogated. So we've maintained the order of priority. Some of the cases talk about order of priority, like Gary and Ruckel. And the problem with those cases and why the made-whole doctrine applied in Gary and Ruckel is because the insurance companies tried to step out of line and recover in subrogation before its insurance even collected $1 from the insurance company. Again, we haven't done that. Dufour collected all the sums that he was entitled to before we asserted our subrogation claim. Now, if I may finish a bit with Van Orden, the court also said there that the insured didn't have access to the funds, and it also noted that subrogation is designed to prevent a double recovery. And that court said if the insured in that case were paid his property damage twice, he would be permitted a double recovery, which thwarts the purpose of subrogation, which is the same thing the Court of Appeals decision does here. It thwarts the purpose of subrogation by allowing Dufour to recover for his property damage twice.
Well, how much was his real damages? I mean, you say he got $215,000.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the number. I know it's more than $215,000 because we stipulated that the value of his injuries, the total value of his injuries, exceeded the value of the funds that he received. But I don't know. Mr. Abraham probably can.
Okay.
Address
so,
that.
If you added both the bodily injury and the property damage, he was not made whole.
I'm disinclined to say that. I'll say the value of his injuries exceeded the value of the funds he received, and the reason I'm disinclined to say that is because I consider made whole to be a legal term of art.
All right.
And in this circumstance, it's Dairyland's position that he was made whole, because the made-whole doctrine simply does not apply due to the absence of competition for a limited pool of funds.
All right. We'll go back to what my original question was.
Sure.
He didn't recover all of his damages. That is, all that he was injured, because he was injured to more than $215,000.
That's true.
And you would like a legal definition of made-whole, not a practical one.
That's how I think of it, Your Honor. So mm-hmm. That's why I make the distinction. I'm not trying to fence with you. I just
make
a distinction conceptually.
Yeah. The Montana case had a very, I thought, dissent that was very persuasive. I guess you didn't.
No, I don't.
Why not?
One point the dissent makes that I don't think makes sense is that you can put all the funds into one pot. And in order to do that, the court has to rewrite the policy. The policy provides separate limits for bodily injury and for property damage. And in order to allow the insured in Dufour's position to be paid twice for his property damage, the court has to take his policy that provides separate limits and rewrite it into one that provides for a combined single limit.
Isn't MedPay separate from your MedPay limit is separate and distinct from your bodily injury limit, right?
In our policy, that's true. There is a separate coverage for MedPay, and there's a separate premium for that as
that's
well.
That's why I think that your argument really extends to MedPay. In Rhymes, I'm not sure. I'm trying to test it. In Rhymes, the money was paid into the clerk's office. But let's say that instead the carrier paid the $10,000 limit for MedPay. Let's say
right.
That's what the limit is. And then went after the tortfeasor's insurer was vis-a-vis subrogation claim, right?
Right.
Was reimbursed and had the $10,000 then in its coffers, right?
Yes.
Now, then does your analysis and your argument encompass MedPay as well as property damage?
Yes, it does.
I think it does.
If we were crimes in the first instance, I'd be making the same argument that I am now.
I think and so, that, too. And that's why I think you're also undermining my minds. I mean, your argument is, whether or not it should be, is, you know, I don't know. But because you are also making the same argument for MedPay as you would be for subrogated claim for property damage.
Yes, and I see that my red light is on, if I may conclude.
Yes. Would it be okay for him to say real quickly, 2, 3, 4, 5, without explanation?
I did cover them in the course of my argument, but if I'm going to enumerate them, yes.
Without explanation.
Sure. The first reason is the made-whole doctrine doesn't apply because there's no competition. The second reason is the policy provides separate coverages for bodily injury and for property damage, and the court shouldn't rewrite the policy to provide for a combined single limit to allow his property damage coverage to pay for his bodily injuries. Number three, as I discussed with Justice Gableman, is that only the insurance company owns the claim for subrogation. Number four is that subrogation is designed to prevent a double recovery. And the Court of Appeals decision here allows Dufour to collect his property damage twice. And then number five is that the case that Dufour relies on, Valley Forge, doesn't apply because it's distinguishable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'm James Friedman from Godfrey & Kahn, and I'm here representing Amicus Curiae, the Wisconsin Insurance Alliance, and the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. I want to thank the Court for the opportunity to participate in this case, and in particular in today's argument. I would like to make 3 points, and hopefully I will get them out. I'll try to be brief and not redundant. First, the Court of Appeals decision here ignores the public policies that this Court has enumerated behind subrogation law and the made-whole doctrine. And as a result, it leads to unintended adverse consequences. Subrogation, whether contractual or common law, is based on equitable principles and is intended to preserve the rights of both the insurer and the insured. Similarly, the made-whole rule is not an absolute rule, and neither of them lend themselves to black-letter rules, as this Court made very clear in the Mueller case. And certainly, made-whole is not intended to entirely rewrite insurance contracts. Unfortunately, if the Court of Appeals decision stands in this case, insurers in Dairyland's position will have little, if any, incentive to enforce their subrogation rights. They will be better off, as we noted in our brief, doing nothing. They won't be here spending money fighting about this, and they won't have wasted the time to get their subrogation interest only to write a check right back to their insured. But the insured, the injured party in this case, will not benefit under those circumstances. The tortfeasor will benefit, entirely in contrast to this Court's admonition in Mueller. The insurance company is in worse shape. The tortfeasor is no better off. The injured party is no better off. Only the tortfeasor will benefit under the Court of Appeals decision. And the insured will end up paying as much or more as they had before with no chance of recovery. And as a result, they're going to have to change their underwriting, potentially the pricing of liability policies like those at issue in this case. Taken to an extreme, it will incentivize the injured party's insurer to try to delay and avoid making the payment with the understanding that at the end, the tortfeasor is going to have to make this payment. And so rather than stepping up, as Dairyland did in this place, in this case, excuse me, and paying its insured for the motorcycle, for the property damage, knowing full well someone else was responsible, it's really in the insurer's best interest to sit back and hope that the tortfeasor takes care of it before they worry about violating their contractual obligations.
Well, lest they be on the fence for bad faith, though. I mean, you know, you can't twiddle your thumbs and wait for a resolution.
No, absolutely not, Justice Bradley. And that's the point I tried to make at the end, which is they're not going to violate their contractual obligations, their duties of good faith and fair dealing under the contract. But it certainly is in their best interest to say, boy, I hope that the tortfeasor pays quickly, rather than writing a check and saying, well, I'm going to get this back at the end, assuming that the accident played out the way I understand it from my insured. Second, the Court of Appeals decision reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of liability insurance contracts. Dairyland, in this case, is being forced to bear a risk that it simply did not assume in the contract. There are two ways to look at it, but one of them is that the Court of Appeals decision will force Dairyland to pay $15,000, a little more than $15,000, for bodily injury after it already has paid 100% of its bodily injury limits. It wrote a check for $100,000. That's it. And now, essentially, based on what Mr. Dufour is asking, he's saying, well, look, I want that $15,000 because my bodily injury is worse. But Dairyland contracted to pay no more in an underinsured motorist situation than $100,000. It did that. So you can call it a double recovery on his motorcycle, or you can call it $115,000 of bodily injury. Both of them are outside of the contract that Dairyland entered.
Well, what was the contract about property damage? How much did they agree to pay?
$40,000. Okay. It's a separate limit. With a separate insuring agreement, and there wasn't $40,000 of property damage here. There was a little over $15,000. This result is inequitable. It's contrary to the clear language in the policy. Mr. Dufour paid for $100,000 of bodily injury insurance, not $115,000, and he paid for separate limits on bodily injury and property damage, and yet the Court of Appeals decision would treat them as if they were the same limit.
How do you get around Rhymes, which says you can co-mingle MedPay, which has a separate limit with bodily injury?
Well, I think there are a couple ways you can distinguish Rhymes. I also think Mueller already has at least implicitly limited Rhymes, and I think we're here today because the court is interested in looking at how what it has done in Mueller and cases subsequent to Rhymes, how that affects made whole and subrogation. But there are distinguishing factors, and the key one is the same as in Valley Forge, which is this is not a situation where the insurer is having to, you know, go to court and sue to try to get its money back. It's the only one, as Mr. Raines noted, that had a right to recover this money. And as I noted earlier, if the Court of Appeals decision stands, nobody's going to get it. The tortfeasor is going to keep the money. I see my red light is on, so I will stop.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Attorney Jason Abraham from Hupie and Abraham. I think the Court of Appeals here obviously got it right, and I think what's being glossed over here by Dairyland is what they're really asking the court to do is throw out the window all its pre-existing subrogation law and a bedrock portion of tort law that a plaintiff's claim is indivisible. For the first time here today, we heard Dairyland say that they're actually contesting the Rhymes decision. That has not been in any of their previous briefs or anything they've said before. And I think one thing that is abundantly clear here is that under tort law, plaintiff has one separate and distinct claim. The plaintiff pays for property damage, a separate premium, for med pay, for bodily injury.
Well, I think if I understand the difference, and if I'm off the track, fix it for me. I understand that they have one claim against the tortfeasor because he injured your client while he was on his cycle and was apparently at fault. But I think the separation that's being argued on the other side is a contractual separation. It's not the same as the claim for being hit by someone who is negligent It's an argument that the contract has separate parts. So I don't see them as really throwing out the doctrine that there's one claim for this accident. Can you straighten me out?
Sure. I'd be happy to. They are throwing out the doctrine that there's one claim and also the doctrine of subrogation, because it is clear under their policy that they do not get subrogation until it's allowed by law. And we have to look at Rhymes, we have to look at Garrity, we have to look at Ruckel to first see if they're entitled to any subrogation under the made whole law, and it is clear that they're not. When the accident first happens, my client has two opportunities, two choices to make as to where to go to get property damage money. He could decide, because he paid for a separate premium, to get that from his own company, from Dairyland. Or we could have made the position that we want to deal with American Standard for that property damage at the outset. We could have made a choice as to where we wanted to go, because both of those contracts were on the hook for property damage.
You're not done yet. Because Chief Justice Rogensack is asking a question that I was trying to get at with the verdict form initially. Finish what you were...
Well, I probably didn't phrase it well. You started by saying that they're asking us to throw out our law that says there's one claim. And what I was saying is I don't hear them saying that there's more than one claim for the accident that occurred, the negligence of someone that caused an injury to your client. What they're saying is there are several claims that can be made under the contract. So I thought a different claim that they were talking about than you're talking about. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, but I don't believe that's what they're saying, Judge.
Okay.
Quite honestly, I believe what they're saying is the made whole doctrine here does not apply, because you should look at these little buckets of coverage. They're trying to avoid the argument that it's one claim, because it's pretty clear if it is in fact one claim, they lose, because you won't get to subrogation because the plaintiff is not made whole.
See, I thought they were setting their contract on top of your claim and figuring how it covered the claim.
They may be saying that, but Ruckel clearly says that that's not the way it should be looked at. I mean, if you look at the Ruckel case, it says that they're not entitled to subrogation against its insured unless and until the insured is made whole, regardless of the contractual language to the contrary.
What's your response, counsel, to Mr. Friedman's contention that if the Court of Appeals opinion is allowed to stand, it means one of two things, that either there's been a double recovery for the property loss, the $15,000, or there's been an overage in the amount of personal injury coverage that was bargained for in the contract from increasing from 100 to 115,000.
I would say that's not the case, because if you look at the available funds here, there is 16,000 in available funds from the property damage under an American Standard policy that they were contracted and paid to pay. There's 16,000 available in property damage funds that Dairyland was contracted to pay through my client, Mr. DeFore. Then there's a $100,000 liability limit and a $100,000 UIM limit. All parties have conceded that Mr. DeFore's damages exceed all of those limits. So the question here isn't one of double recovery. The question is one of subrogation. And I think that's what's happening here, and where the confusion and why the Court of Appeals got it right, and why actually Valley Forge is on all fours with this case.
Those two ideas kind of butt up against each other, though, don't they?
I don't believe they do.
Well, but let's talk about it. You have the contractual limits, and the limit for bodily injury that's applicable, as I understand it from reading the briefs and listening to the arguments so far, is $100,000. You just brought up, I think, another $100,000 that's out there. But as I understand it, we're talking about a $100,000 bodily injury limit that's applicable to this case. Am I wrong?
No, you're right.
Okay. And then... You have the limit of the $40,000 for the property damage. Now the motorcycle, $16,000. So how do we harmonize the two ideas that your client has not been made whole for his bodily injury, Everyone agrees with that, right? That he hasn't received enough money to make up. The $200,000 has not compensated him for the bodily injury. Yes?
Correct.
Okay. So we've got that fact, but then we have the fact of the policy limits of $100,000 and $40,000. So you have the limit, but the limit here satisfies, is enough to satisfy the $16,000 claim. So tell me again how it is that your client would not be getting more coverage than he bargained for if the Court of Appeals opinion was allowed to stand.
Because you don't look at the available coverage under the property damage. You're looking at whether or not Dairyland has the right to subrogate and get those funds. If the court rules that made whole applies and my client was not made whole, Century Dairyland did not have the right to those funds in the first instance. Since Valley Forge...
They didn't have the right to the $16,000.
They did not.
But they paid the $16,000.
They had the right, they had the obligation to pay me $16,000 because
did.
We paid the premium. And they did.
Okay.
And then when they subrogated back to get that $16,000 from American Standard,
yes.
They did not have the right to keep it.
Why not?
Because my client was not made whole. And if you look at Rhymes, Garrity, Ruckel, Paulson, they all indicate that in the event that the plaintiff is not made whole for all elements of their damage, they are not first entitled to subrogation.
When you're done with Justice Gableman, can I go back to
go
the
ahead,
question?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Walk me through this case a little bit. I just need to simplify it. The first summons and complaint related to the motorcycle accident and what should be paid for that, right?
Correct.
Okay. And that had each of the parties in it that were in the amended summons and complaint, except for Mr. Lucaro, right? Or no?
It may have been the individual defendant, tortfeasor, I don't know.
I mean, Dairyland was in both, right? The insurance companies were in both.
I believe they were, Your Honor.
Okay. So if you never had the second one, you only had the first one, what would the damages look like for that case? Could Dairyland be out with a $100,000 payment?
Could they? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Would they pay their limits with $100,000?
Yeah, they would pay their limits of $100,000.
Okay. So when you amended the summons and complaint, that's the one we're talking about here, right?
I amended the summons and complaint to allege bad faith when they wouldn't
right.
make the Valley Forge payment.
Okay. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. The difference between what your client could have received with the first summons and complaint and didn't get from Dairyland and what they should have received under the second summons and complaint without the bad faith. I understand that's a different kettle of fish with the damages. But the dollar figure you're saying that was missing was they really should have paid out, it kind of sounds like you're saying they should have paid out $115,000 on their $100,000 max.
Well, it's not the max. I believe what should have been paid with the first lawsuit would have been everything we were entitled to, which would have been $232,000.
Okay. But the first one was settled or something happened, and Dairyland, anyway, paid their limits of $100,000, right?
Well, no. What happened was, Your Honor, American Standard paid their limits of $100,000.
Okay.
Dairyland had paid $16,000, and then we gave the appropriate vote notice
I see what
to Dairyland, and I think that's a real important point to think about here, and that is they
before
waived...
Before it settled?
Yes.
Okay.
Because I could not settle with the underlying tortfeasor for the $100,000 without first Dairyland acquiescing in that settlement and giving up their right of subrogation as to the insured personally. So we followed the vote procedure, and they acquiesced and said that we could accept the money from American Standard and continue on against them. They did not say we couldn't continue on for Valley Forge money. They didn't say we wouldn't follow the rules of Rhymes and Garrity. So we never waived our right with the underlying settlement to get the money from Dairyland for property damage that they received from American Standard. That was never waived because they acquiesced and they signed off on it pursuant to vote, that settlement, and waived their right of subrogation.
You know, I understand your argument in this case, and if I were in your spot, I'd be arguing probably the same thing, but we don't take your case or decide it for the people before us. And if we decided in your favor, when is an insurance company ever going to bother to collect from the tortfeasor for monies they paid to their insured by trying to settle things out quickly? When are they ever going to go collect those monies?
That's a really, really good point, and one I was going to get to, and I'm
good.
Glad that you asked
That's
the question,
okay.
Because it really is a red herring for this court, and I want to make sure the court understands that in probably 95% or more of the cases, Dairyland is able to subrogate and accept these monies. This happens so infrequently, it's almost shocking, to be honest, that we're here. From 1986, when Valley Forge was decided, up until the denial from Dairyland by letter in this case, saying they've just decided right now not to pay, insurance companies were paying Valley Forge money. Dairyland was paying Valley Forge money. And the reason why is because what happens in these cases, when you get property damage right away.
You're not answering my question.
I'm getting there right now.
Okay.
When you get property damage money right away from your company, they, through intercompany arbitration, immediately get the money back. The two companies. They have intercompany arbitration. They get the money back. The only time that this problem comes into existence that we're talking about here today and that Valley Forge talked about is when the plaintiff isn't made whole from the first liability limit. The plaintiff is also not made whole from the second liability limit, and there are two parties that are on the hook for property damage. I can tell you from a firm that probably handles the most cases of any other firm in Wisconsin, this happens, I would say, less than 5% of the time, could be 2% of the time, that you align all those factors together. So for them to stand up here and say, why would we ever go back after subrogation is ridiculous, because 98% of the time they're going to be able to keep it.
Well, did they have to try to get the 15?
No, I don't believe they did. If you look at Valley Forge in that case.
No, they don't, because they would.
But they got it right away.
But so you're really, if I'm understanding both sides' arguments, what is their incentive to try to get that?
Because 98% of the time they're going to be able to keep it. And they get it right away from the other company, so they're not out the money. It is so rare that they're going to have to give that back to me, because you have to align all those facts I talked about. So are they going to give it away 98% of the time to lose it 2% of the time? No. Are they going to not get it?
If the plaintiff isn't made whole and two parties are on the hook for property damage, those are the occasions when they won't go after the money.
Correct. I mean, look at if you think about it conceptually.
How does that benefit your client?
Pardon me?
I see that as not benefiting your client at all, other than today.
Well, it benefits the clients the same reason under Rhymes. It benefits all the same clients that Rhymes benefits under MedPay coverage. It benefits the people when you look at the equities, and subrogation is based on equities. It benefits those insureds that are not made whole as a result of the damages. If you're going to have somebody bear the cross here, should you have the cross borne by the insurance companies who are getting the premiums and understand these risks, or should it be borne by the innocent third party? There was another argument that was made by the...
Can I just ask you, are you asking that we impose a duty on them to recover that for your client? And it's bad faith if they don't?
No, the money was already grabbed by Dairyland, and I think
but
the company will.
But I'm just assuming in the future, if today comes out your way, in the future, they're going to say, why bother? We don't get to keep it. Why would we hire lawyers to go after it or try to get it? So,
well, the issue
bother?
Is because I could go after
it. It costs us more to get 15 than it
Sorry
doesn't.
To interrupt.
So why would they ever pursue that, and why would that ever benefit your client in the future? I'm looking at it from a practical perspective, unless, as part of this, we're deciding if you don't go after that and give it to the plaintiff, then it's bad faith, which might be exactly what you're asking for. I just need to button that up for myself.
I believe, to be honest, it could be bad faith if they don't grab it, and they could, but I could also have gone after American Standard first and got my money from them first, and then No, I couldn't have done that, excuse me. Because then the law of subrogation would apply, excuse me.
I'm just trying to figure, you know.
No, I think potentially it could be bad faith for them not to get it. But I think they're going to get it in every circumstance. And I'll tell you why. Because they're not going to know at the outset whether or not you're going to have been able to line up all those dots. And they're always getting it. And they've been paying it since 1986. What happened here, which is quite strange, is all of a sudden one day they decide they're not going to pay it and they write a letter that says, we don't believe Valley Forge is good law. We don't believe it applies in this case. And what they said their only difference was because they have possession of the funds now. And an analogy I guess I would give you, it doesn't matter who has the funds in their hands now. It matters who's entitled to the funds. So we have to get back to the law of subrogation and decide who's entitled to the money. What if we had a situation where I was at Starbucks this morning on my way over here, and I was going to pay, and I dropped a $20 bill on the floor, and somebody quicker than me grabbed the $20 and put it in their pocket, and they said, well, I grabbed it, it's mine, and you can't have it back.
That reminds me of when we were kids, we used to say, finders keepers, losers weepers. Yeah,
they may have, but I'm standing right there, and they drop down quicker than me, and they grab it, and they put it in their pocket, and they say it's mine. Are they entitled to that money because they grabbed it first? If the Court of Appeals is wrong, then all there's going to be is a race for them to grab the money right away and then say, even though you weren't made whole and even though you paid a premium, we want to throw out all these previous cases that talk about subrogation and we're going to keep the money ourselves even though the plaintiff's not made whole. The equitable principles of subrogation do not allow that to happen because if someone is going to bear that $16,000 loss, it should be the company that's getting the premium. It shouldn't be the innocent third party.
Could I ask a question? I want to make sure I understand exactly what happened here. On the Dairyland policy, they paid out $100,000. Was that on underinsured motorist coverage?
Correct.
Okay. And then they paid out money out of that $40,000 line?
16.
I'm sorry. 16 out of the $40,000 line.
Correct.
Now, there's some other things here about, for example, medical expenses. Did they pay out any money for medical expenses?
I believe if there was MedPay coverage, they would have paid MedPay coverage, correct? I just don't recall as I'm sitting here right now if there was MedPay coverage.
Are they entitled to subrogation on that, too?
No. I mean, unless you overturn Rhymes, it's clear they're not.
They're not. Anything else here? For example, even rental car expenses.
Since it was a motorcycle, Your Honor, I don't recall if there was any loss of use paid, but they would not have asked. They didn't. I don't know if it was paid. And if they did, they weren't asking for that money back either. I just don't know as we sit here.
But anything that hasn't been determined not to apply, where there's potential subrogation, you're saying if Dairyland pays it out, they should go after the other company for it, and then that should be part of the pot. Is that right?
No. I'm saying if Dairyland pays MedPay under the Rhymes case, unless my client's not made whole, they're not entitled to subrogation. That's clear under Rhymes, unless Rhymes is overturned here today. That's directly dealt with in Rhymes. I believe Valley Forge says the same thing for property damage. Once they get that money, it's when the client is not made whole, when my client's not made whole, it comes back to me. Because you look at all elements of damage because it's an indivisible claim. All the case law out there in Wisconsin has said it's an indivisible claim. Another thing I would say is there is not one Wisconsin case where the plaintiff was not made whole by the available insurance where subrogation was allowed. I know of none.
Is it a logical extension of your argument to say then that your client should have received the full property damage policy limits under the Dairyland policy, which I believe are $40,000 because those limits are available? And if we don't look at the separate, if we don't look at the claim separately and the different coverages, you could just combine those limits so that your client would get more money toward being made whole looking at it in the aggregate.
No, I don't believe so. Because under that limit, you paid for coverage for $40,000 in property damage, and we only suffered $16,000 in property damage under that limit. I believe, again, we're looking at this, quotes, double recovery instead of looking at the real issue, which is subrogation. And I quickly want to turn to Miller, because that's a recent case here, and talk about Miller and say, really, the distinction in Miller was that the plaintiff could have received more money but chose not to. That is not the case here. This is not a Miller case. This would only be a Miller case if it was a property damage case only.
What would the verdict have looked like in the underlying motorcycle accident?
It would have looked like medical bills, pain and suffering, future medical bills, wage loss, property damage if it hadn't been paid, future pain and suffering, future wage loss, okay. And then a total.
And then a total.
And then the question would have been at the end, just like we talked about earlier in Rhymes, who would be entitled to what with that aggregate sum of money? And in my mind, if this case would have been tried and the verdict would have been $500,000, the medical pay would not have been able to get their money back based on Rhymes. We would have been able to get the additional $16,000 from Century Dairyland because my client would not have been made whole. So the verdict form would be a traditional plaintiff's verdict form. And then what happens with subrogation is dealt with by the court later. Because that's a legal question. It's not a factual question for the jury to decide. Just like a court, you don't put med pay down on the verdict. You just put what are the medical expenses.
Right.
I think one other thing I want to talk about, and that is bad faith, real quickly, if I can. We received a letter that more or less just said, we don't want to pay anymore, so we're not going to pay. We understand that Valley Forge is good law. We don't like the way it was decided. So therefore, we are now at this time going to decide we're just not going to pay it. If you look at some of the other cases when insurance companies have affirmative duties, coverage issues, they have to take action. Rhymes, money placed in trust. That was never done here. They have an obligation under the law as it existed, I believe, to pay that $16,000 to me because I think Valley Forge is on all fours with this case. The Montana case isn't even close to on all fours because there's a statute dealing with subrogation in Montana, and they don't define made whole the same way we define made whole here. So to talk about that case and act like it's the law is just not the case because we don't have a subrogation statute here like Montana does, and we do not have the same definition of made whole as Montana does. So that case does not apply at all here.
Do you think that what you're asking is that we make Valley Forge and Rhymes work together to make sure the plaintiff is made whole regardless of whether the damages are for property damages or something else?
Well, the plaintiff is never going to be made whole regardless under either of these analyses because if the claim is worth $1 million, what we're talking about is an additional 16. And the issue is, should the insurance company, when their contract says we're only entitled to subrogation when the law allows it, that's what Dairyland's policy says here, and we have a myriad of cases that have for years defined what subrogation means and what made whole means and when they should get money, Garrity says they may recover nothing until the plaintiff is made whole.
What if you have a case where property damage is really a larger figure and the other figure is smaller and the recovery is, do you see what I'm saying? I see you as kind of saying, put it all in one big pot and make sure the plaintiff is covered first before the insurance companies get any money back. And I mean, that's a viable thing to ask for, but that's what I'm hearing you say. Kind of extend Rhymes to this area of...
I'm not asking for any extension. I believe the case law is clear as it is right now.
Because you think that's what Valley Forge already does.
Valley Forge already says that the plaintiff is entitled. I mean, look at when we talk about what a reasonable insurance company would do, look what Home Mutual did under those circumstances. They didn't have any case law talking about property damage cases when that case was decided. Home Mutual was confronted with a circumstance where they had to decide in their own mind, what do we do with that property, that $6,000? There's Garrity and Rhymes out there. And then there's Valley Forge asking us to pay the money to them, and the plaintiff is asking, pay the money to me. And Home Mutual looked at all the facts and circumstances, and they made a decision based on Garrity and Rhymes that we think the money should go to the injured party. That's what Home Mutual did in that case. because Valley Forge was screaming up and down for the money, and in fact, then Valley Forge sued their own insurer to get the money back. So if you look at a reasonable insurer, that was Home Mutual, who made the decision that under Garrity and Rimes, we should pay this money to that injured party, because if someone's going to bear that loss, it should be the injured party, because the insurance companies are getting the value. And one last thing I'd say, I see my red light is on. Under Schulte, this court has already determined that subrogation does not increase premiums, and it actually, and also the case of Insurance Company of North America, says it may be a windfall to the insurance company subrogation. So there can be no argument made here, a credible argument, that anyone's premiums are going to go up or any of those things. Because if you look at Schulte and you look at Insurance Company of North America, there's no actuarial data at all to show that subrogation in these circumstances are going to increase premiums. In fact, the data shows it's a windfall to insurance companies.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal? Oh, sorry about that. Go ahead. I didn't look back at my list. Please.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court again. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak on behalf of the Wisconsin Association for Justice. I want to turn right away to Chief Justice Rogensack's point to kind of alleviate this conceptual confusion. The idea of Justice Rogensack's previous question was, well, how does this concept of the indivisible claim work hand-in-hand with the way that policies are divided? And that question was answered finally and fully in the Rimes case, and I'll quote from Rimes at page, Wisconsin Reporter, page 275. Under Wisconsin law, the test of wholeness depends upon whether the insured has been completely compensated for all elements of damage, not merely those elements for which the insurer has indemnified the insured. We pointed out in Garrity that the cause of action against the tortfeasor is indivisible. Accordingly, it's only when there has been full compensation for all the damage elements of the entire cause of action that the insured is made whole. Now, we've got the insurer here for the first time saying that Rimes, which is the bedrock case of our made whole jurisprudence, should be overruled, and that in Rimes, in fact, this court should have held the opposite and should have allowed subrogation. That's not conceptually the way we look at it. If we take a step back and we think about the concept of subrogation and the made whole rule, there is always, arguably, a double payment made for one item of loss. That's what subrogation is. A health insurance company pays a medical expense for the plaintiff, and the plaintiff also can recover that medical expense under a bodily injury liability policy. But we say there's no subrogation until the plaintiff has been made whole for all damages. It makes no difference whether it's property damage, whether it's medical expense, or whether it's a disability benefit for an earning capacity loss, for example. The insurance company's argument would allow subrogated insurers to come back before this court and other courts in virtually every case and argue that they're entitled to subrogation regardless of whether the plaintiff is made whole or not.
Did Rimes parse the damages that might have been available? I see the quote that you made to me. I have Rimes here with me on the bench. Did they parse the different types of damages and what was recovered under each or not?
Yes. In fact, in Rimes dealt with medical payments coverage rather than property damage coverage. It's an insurance coverage available to someone who is damaged as a result of an automobile accident. Mm-hmm. In Rimes, the argument from the insurer is, well, we paid $10,000 in medical payments coverage. Plaintiff, you were able to go recover $10,000 under the liability limit, which was higher than the medical payments coverage. So we should be able to subrogate because, in essence, you were double paid for that element of damage. However, this court decided and has decided consistently ever since, when there are insufficient limits to compensate the plaintiff for the entirety of their damage, there is no subrogation. The loss is borne by the subrogor rather than the injured plaintiff. The injured plaintiff is fully compensated up to all of the available limits. And this goes to Justice Bradley's point about, well, isn't the plaintiff making the argument that the entirety of the coverage, the $40,000 of property damage coverage, should be available to the plaintiff? No. The plaintiff is allowed to recover all of those coverages that are available to the plaintiff conceptually, which includes property damage on two policies. It probably included health benefits and MedPay benefits, liability benefits, and UIM benefits, and there's no subrogation on anything unless the plaintiff is made whole, and the court confirmed that in the case of Ruckle v. Grassner, and the court said that rule applies regardless of contractual language to the contrary. This isn't a case where the plaintiff is trying to get something they're not entitled to. They're entitled to property damage under both policies. The question is, who is entitled to retain those funds?
But in Rhymes, weren't the MedPay, it says $9,649, that sure. was the medical pay provisions of the two policies, what they paid, and they had coverage of five a policy under his and his wife's cars, so they had $10,000 available, right? And out of the $10,000 available, $9,649 was paid.
Yes.
So if the insurer came back and wanted his $5,000, then you would be taking away from the insured an amount that was actually incurred by the insured for medical pay, right?
Correct. And in this case, the insured... Right.
Well, but the insured here only incurred $15,000-some-odd, almost $16,000 for his bike.
Right.
He didn't incur $32,000.
Yes, but there is coverage available for that $16,000 of the bike under two separate policies. Just like in Rhymes, the insured incurred a certain amount of medical expenses, and there was coverage available under both MedPay and under liability.
But
just
in
like
Rhymes,
here.
If you took away $5,000 from $9,649, he's not going to be paid fully for MedPay. Here, if you take away the $16,000, he's still fully paid for his bike.
Well, arguably in Rhymes, that's not the case because the medical expenses may have grossly exceeded the $9,000. I don't believe it's broken down in the case, but okay. Certainly the total damages and probably because the damages were several hundred thousand dollars. The total of the medical expense damage was not $9,000. It was much higher.
Okay.
So the total damages is how we look at it. That's what the court said in Rhymes, and that's what the court's confirmed in every subrogation case ever since. Miller, the only reason that Miller is decided differently, and the court says this in the first summary paragraph, is because the plaintiff unilaterally decided to accept less than the total limit available. The plaintiff essentially unilaterally limited, without a good reason, the plaintiff's claim. The question here is not one of who is entitled to the funds. There is no question about that. Mr. Dufour is entitled to recover property damage under both policies. The only question is subrogation allowed when the plaintiff is clearly not made whole? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, rebuttal.
I want to pick up on what my colleague was just saying about Rhymes, about collecting all elements of damages. That presupposes that the made whole doctrine applies. And Mueller says, this is paragraph 50, that there's no absolute rule that the insured has to be made whole before the insurance company can subrogate. There's three forms, and the made whole doctrine doesn't apply, as I said before, where there's no competition. There are three forms of competition. One, where the insurance company is suing its insured directly for subrogation. That was the case in Garrity, it was the case in Rhymes, but it was absent in Mueller, and it's absent here. The second form of competition is when the insured settles with the tortfeasor and provides an indemnity agreement. That creates competition because one way or another, when the insurance company subrogates, money is going to have to come out of the insured's pocket. Dufour didn't provide an indemnity agreement here, so there's no competition in that respect. And it distinguishes this case from Schulte, from Valley Forge, from Kajawa, and from PETA. In all four of those cases, the insured settled with the tortfeasor and provided an indemnity agreement, and that indemnity agreement created the competition that triggered the application of the made whole doctrine in those cases. The third form of competition is when the insurance company steps in front of its insured and tries to collect from the tortfeasor before his own insured has a chance to. And that was the case in Garrity and in Ruckle. In those cases, the insurance companies tried to step in front of the tortfeasor and collect in subrogation before the insured had collected even $1 from the tortfeasor. And the court said that type of reordering of priority is not allowed and triggers the made whole doctrine. So if I'm going to set up the cases in sort of a matrix here, the cases that permit subrogation, or I'm sorry, that trigger the made whole doctrine are Garrity, Rhymes, Valley Forge, Schulte, Kajawa, PETA, and Ruckle. Those are all distinguishable on one basis or another. Garrity and Rhymes, again, the insured is suing its own insured in subrogation. That doesn't apply here. Valley Forge, Schulte, Kajawa, Peta, the insured provided an indemnity agreement. That's not the case here. It wasn't the case in Mueller. In Ruckel and Garrity, again, the insurance companies were trying to step ahead of their own insured to collect from the tortfeasor before the own insured collected dollar one. All those cases are distinguishable then. So what we have is Mueller and what we have is Van Orden. I disagree with my colleague that Van Orden doesn't apply because there was a statute involved in Van Orden. The statute in Van Orden is completely analogous to the common law of Wisconsin. The statute in Van Orden said that insurance companies were permitted to put in their insurance policies reasonable subrogation agreements that said that they didn't have to pay twice for a loss. And that's what the purpose of subrogation is in common law. Insurance companies are permitted to put subrogation clauses in their contracts, just as we did.
Now, is it your position that we don't have to overrule or any of these prior cases?
You don't have to overrule Valley Forge to rule that Dairyland may retain the subrogated funds.
What about Rhymes?
No, you don't have to overrule that, too. And I do want to address that briefly because it's been suggested that we're now saying that Rhymes should be overturned. We're not saying that. When I was addressing Justice Bradley's questioning, what I was trying to convey was that a matter of litigation strategy, if we could go back in time, if Dairyland could go back in time to 1978 at the time of Rhymes, we would have not voluntarily allowed our insured access to the MedPay funds by paying them into escrow. I think that was a mistake tactfully because it's only the insurance company who owns the claim for subrogation. The insured wouldn't have been permitted access to those funds otherwise, just as the insured in Valley Forge wouldn't have been able to access the subrogated funds, the double property damage funds, but for the tortfeasor's insurance company electing voluntarily to pay him directly. I want to address bad faith very quickly. I'm running out of time. But it is not bad faith for an insurance company to challenge a 30-year-old Court of Appeals decision that doesn't apply and that the circuit court appropriately said doesn't make a lot of sense and is contrary to rational legal thought. There's a companion Jarovitz case arising out of Brown County. It's currently pending in District 2 of the Court of Appeals. It's on all fours with this case. Judge Hammer and Jarovitz said, Dairyland not only didn't commit a bad faith, but also didn't even commit a breach of contract. The Court of Appeals here essentially said that Dairyland committed bad faith because from the Court of Appeals perspective, we were challenging Valley Forge. This is paragraphs 31 and 36 of the Court of Appeals decision. But the question is not whether we challenge Valley Forge. The question is whether our challenge to Valley Forge is reasonable based on our defenses. And the answer is yes. The circuit court called our defenses reasonable, rational, justifiable. And they are, because the Van Orden court followed them. All four points that I laid out in my opening, the Van Orden court followed. I want to make one more point about bad faith. I see my red light is on, but one of the early bad faith cases in this state is Anderson. And Anderson says that bad faith is deceit and duplicity. Dufour doesn't even argue that we engaged in deceit and duplicity. In fact, at the hearing before the circuit court, Dufour acknowledged that our defenses have merit. This is page 45 of the appendix. And he's right. They do have merit. And because of that, the issue is at least fairly debatable, and we didn't commit any bad faith. So for all these reasons, I respectfully request the court reverse the Court of Appeals decision in all respects. Thank you.
Well, thank you for very engaging arguments. They're very enjoyable. And we are going to take a break now for noontime, and we will be back again at 1:30.